Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Leper Spy, the story of an unlikely hero of World War II, by Ben Montgomery, narrated by Joe Barrett. One life is all we have, and we live it as we believe in living it, and then it's gone. But to surrender what you are and live without belief, that's more terrible than dying, more terrible than dying young. Joan of Arc in Joan of Lorraine by Maxwell Anderson. Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. Gospel of Matthew. Introduction. The End. Washington, D.C. In the last years, when she was living quiet and alone in the bustling capital of a country that had forgotten who she was and what she had done, she never spoke of the war. She kept the stories inside her head. No more bullets bit the dirt at her feet, and the flash bulbs had long since faded. Her few friends around town had no idea that she had once walked unflinching through crossfire half a world away, helping the fallen to their feet and closing the eyelids of the dead. They never knew the diminutive woman did something so daring that a U.S. Army major general pinned a medal to her breast and said she had more courage than that of a soldier on the field of battle, and that a Jesuit priest called her one of the greatest heroes of the war. They would ask where she was from, and she'd tell them she was born inside an airplane high over the Pacific, or in San Francisco. Nothing more. No one even knew her real name. Her posture was perfect, but she was tiny and easy to miss on the broad boulevards of Washington, D.C., the lines of taillights stretching forever past her, the sidewalks a two-way stream of people trying to get somewhere else. She'd dress in a black skirt and plain white blouse, and pull on a long coat, and slip out of her apartment on New Hampshire Avenue, and walk a few blocks in the fading sun to the grand John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts on the east bank of the Potomac, where she was Joey Lomax, usher, volunteer. She'd show patrons to their seats with an anonymous smile, then disappear into the shadows to let the music wash over her. That's why she was here, the music. She was a plain person, but she liked to say that the plain is always attracted to the beautiful. She never played an instrument, but she was raised on classical, heard it in her sleep, and it conjured images of her childhood, happy and peaceful, before the war, before her affliction, before she had to disappear in order to live. Her secret ambition had always been to visit all the places where she could embrace music. Carnegie Hall, the Metropolitan Opera House, the Hollywood Bowl. She fed her soul on concertos for piano and violin. She loved Chopin, Beethoven, Debussy, Saint-Saëns, Tchaikovsky. Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel, Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Ravel's Daphnis et Chloé. Her favorite was Brahms, so soothing, like a journey into a land of magic dreams. She was especially fond of his Symphony No. 1 in C minor. Of the four movements, she liked the second best of all. She felt like it was pregnant with unspoken yearnings, secret desires, until finally it broke into the third, the Allegretto, so alive and intense until it reached the finale and the air exploded with music and excitement, like the sudden appearance of a white-hot sun after a rainstorm. To find the music, she had to travel halfway around the world, then battle the great bureaucracy of the U.S. government, then ultimately disappear into the roving citizenry. But finally, she would close her eyes and lose herself in the sound, and at once see her mother and her daughter, whom she had left behind. Her brown-eyed little girl, a stranger now. Those times were past and sealed in a box in her mind, but she would let them out to run and play up the crescendo. She was Joey now. She had a simple apartment overflowing with books and a compact disc player and recent memories of a job as a clerk at the Gold and Silver Institutes, where she typed letters, her eyes straining behind thick glasses. She was always giving her things away, foisting books upon her visitors, who always felt bad because she had so little to give. She walked to Mass every day at St. Stephen Martyr and took the body and blood of Christ into her mouth, a sacred and consistent act, then walked home to be alone. When her heart finally gave out a little after 5 o'clock in the morning of June 18, 1996, there was no grieving or gnashing of teeth. She left behind modest home furnishings, some costume jewelry, 850 books, 2 bags of used foreign stamps, foreign banknotes and traveler's checks, some vinyl records, many autographed ballet, opera, and theater posters, photos, and playbills, and a simple handwritten will and testament, leaving the little money she had after her debts were settled, about $5,000, to a handful of friends. Those trying to settle her affairs also found a mystery. They found address books that, quite curiously, contained only the names of friends she had made starting in the 1970s, none from before. In calling these friends to alert them of Joey's death, no one seemed to know anything about her parents or when or where she was born. Among her possessions, there were no photographs taken prior to the late 1960s and no personal documents with an earlier date. Her passport said her place of birth was Manila, in the Philippine Islands, but none of her friends had ever heard that. She listed her year of birth as 1917, 1927, and 1937 on various documents. Her studio apartment was packed with years of catalogs, newspaper clippings, and correspondence, but there was nothing among her possessions to suggest she had ever been married or had a family. The friends assumed she was born in 1927 and had never married. Her death certificate and obituary would reflect the errors. At her funeral, a man read Desiderata, and they buried her ashes in a box in a marble wall inside a chapel at Mount Olivet Cemetery, on the east side of the city. The funeral was well attended, and her obituary ran in the Washington Post beneath one for a money manager and above one for a chef on June 28, 1996. Joey Guerrero Lomax, Kennedy Center Usher. Joey Guerrero Lomax, 68, a retired secretary who had worked as an usher at the Kennedy Center for the last 17 years, died of cardiopulmonary arrest June 18th at George Washington University Medical Center. Ms. Lomax, who had lived in Washington since 1977, was a secretary in the Publications Department of the Gold and Silver Institutes in Washington from 1977 until her retirement in 1990. She was born in Manila and graduated from San Francisco State University. She received a master's degree in Spanish literature from Middlebury College, then spent 4 years as a Peace Corps volunteer, teaching English, music, and drawing to children and adults in Niger, Colombia, and El Salvador. She was a member of St. Stephen Martyr Catholic Church in Washington. She leaves no immediate survivors. A week after the obituary ran, a man called Joey's friend who had made the funeral arrangements. The man said he had known Joey Lomax by a different name, 50 years ago, in southern Louisiana. He told an astonishing story of a previous chapter of her life, unknown to her friends for the past 30 years. This, of course, is the end of the story, but it's the best place to begin. 1. Everything is in readiness. If you look down on the cluster of 7,107 Philippine Islands from a Mitsubishi G4M bomber in the 1940s, you might see the profile of a stoop-shouldered old woman with her arms bent and her hands drawn up in prayer. Her face, the largest island, would be Luzon, and at the back of her throat sat Manila, the Pearl of the Orient, a bustling Asian city with a unique and diverse cultural tapestry shaped by the indigenous Tagalog Filipino, more than 300 years of Spanish rule, and more recently, 40 years of American occupation. The capital city was headquarters for American interests in the Orient, and the 4 decades of occupation had transformed Manila from a sleepy Spanish city into a thriving metropolis. Add to the mix a bunch of Chinese and Japanese migrants and Scottish and German traders who made Manila their home, and the city's cultural web connected it to 3 different continents and an international heritage. The only facet of culture that wasn't diverse was religion. The Spanish Catholic missions and educational system had converted generations upon generations, leaving few who didn't long for the body and blood of Jesus Christ. Between the deep blue of Manila Bay and the thick jungle, There grew high-rise buildings, apartment complexes, shopping centers, and hotels, and beyond those, fish farms and rice paddies and the brown thatched roofs of bamboo houses. The mist that settled low upon the mountains ringing the city gave it an exotic feel. To the southwest, in the mouth of the ship-speckled bay, rose the rock island of Corregidor, and a bit to the north stood the knuckled knobs of the Batan Peninsula, behind which the sun disappeared each day. On hot nights, the teenagers would drag their portable phonographs down to the seawall on the Vito Cruz corner, opposite the Casa Manana, and stomp to the music until sweat soaked their shirts. The street vendors sold sweet hollow from their carts, click-clacking down the paved roads, while river gypsies pulled their cascos through the choking boat traffic on the Pasig. The bazaars were always packed with customers, searching through straw hats and practical clay pottery, and the Escolta, the busiest boulevard, was a constant flurry of activity, the men darting through automobile and carriage traffic in white suits, and the women sauntering in the heat. Inside the clubs, bodies pulsed every expression, displaying the blending of cultures, the tango, the flamenco, the waltz, the jive. It was a beautiful life, and though relatively short, the overlay of friendly American influence had left an impression. Most Filipinos felt, in some small way, like they were Americans. The young Commonwealth was on the cusp of independence, after 400 years of foreign rule, and the city was filled with a palpable anxiety. The United States was helping lift the Philippines to its feet, and at the head of that effort was a man who was pacing back and forth on the long sixth-floor balcony of the Manila Hotel, high above Dewey Boulevard. Douglas MacArthur was born on a military base in Little Rock, Arkansas, the son of a Civil War hero. He learned how to ride and shoot before he learned how to read and write. He had been valedictorian at West Texas Military Academy, where he played quarterback and shortstop, and first in his class at West Point, and first captain, too. He had been the youngest major general in the U.S. Army, the first American Army officer ever to become a field marshal, and the first American to be a four-star general twice. He smoked a corncob pipe, dressed loud, and wore swagger like cologne. His spine was straight as a flagpole. He had served as chief of staff in the War Department under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but by 1934, near the sunset of his four-year term, developments in the Far East had grown interesting. The Japanese had conquered Manchuria, and Congress passed an act granting Commonwealth status to the Philippines, now on its way to full independence, which would come in 1946. The exuberant leader of the Nacionalista Party, Manuel Quezon, was favored to be the next president of the independent Philippines, and he was working to establish a military to protect the islands. He leaned on MacArthur for help. The general had served in the Philippines before, the first stint starting in 1903, the second in 1922, and the third later that decade. He knew the islands. He loved them. He also knew that politics in Washington were tumultuous. When FDR was adamant about cutting the War Department budget by 51% to pull the federal government out of the red, MacArthur stared down the president. "When we lose the next war, and an American boy with an enemy bayonet through his belly and an enemy foot on his dying throat spits out his last curse, I want the name not to be MacArthur, but Roosevelt," he said, voice trembling. He told the president he was resigning as chief of staff. As he turned to leave, FDR stopped him. "Don't be foolish, Douglas," the president said. "You and the budget must get together on this." Outside, MacArthur vomited on the steps of the White House. Now he was in Manila. His family occupied the six-room penthouse atop the air-conditioned hotel, where he walked miles on the balcony overlooking the bay, Bataan, and Corregidor, wearing his West Point dressing gown and swinging a cane. He had been appointed field marshal in 1936, during a ceremony at Malacañang Palace, where the Commonwealth's First Lady, Aurora Quezon, presented him with a golden baton. He had become the highest-paid professional soldier in the world, and often referred to himself in the third person. Nonetheless, he inspired awe on the streets of Manila. Filipinos loved MacArthur. He spoke to them with respect, and came across as a sort of father figure, a protectorate. They saw him at the theaters, watching The Great Ziegfeld or A Tale of Two Cities, and at social affairs and cocktail parties. It also appealed to the heavily Catholic population that he seemed morally centered and rarely finished a gimlet. MacArthur, meanwhile, was worried about defending the islands. The first measure Quezon put before his new legislature in 1935 had been a defense bill, but it took 2 years before the first 20,000 draftees showed up at training camps, and then it was learned that they spoke 8 languages and 87 dialects, and a fifth of them were illiterate. Nonetheless, MacArthur maintained that the strategically important islands, the key that unlocks the door to the Pacific, as he called them, were defensible, even if they had more total coastline than the United States and were just 1,000 miles from Nagasaki, while they were 7,000 miles from San Francisco. He called for the formation of a Filipino Navy that would man torpedo boats, for 250 aircraft, and for an army force of 400,000 Filipinos. "We're going to make it so very expensive for any nation to attack these islands that no nation will try it," he said. What's more, he regarded Japanese soldiers and pilots as inferior to red-blooded Americans. He knew the Japanese had been whipped by the Soviets during border clashes in 1938 and 39, and that they weren't able to defeat the peasant militias of China after 3 years of fighting. But his war plan needed funding, and every indication was that Washington was iffy with support at best. The War Department failed to allot money so that MacArthur could pay his draftees a pittance. The Filipino trainees were issued pith helmets and shoes that fell apart during exercises, and they were armed with ancient Enfield rifles. As the war churned toward fury elsewhere, the War Department began reassessing plans in the Pacific. The Orange Plan, under which the U.S. Armed Forces had been operating, suddenly felt outdated because it assumed a war between just 2 world powers. An updated plan, drafted in June 1941, proposed abandoning the Philippines to Japan, or defending it without additional military support, so the U.S. effort could focus on defeating Italy and Germany. July had brought a rapid turn of events. American scout planes were reporting large Japanese troop transports moving south. The Japanese had seized nearly every port in China. They also were filling bases in French Indochina. Roosevelt watched Tokyo closely. He was well aware of the rising nationalism in Japan, laid bare in the Japanese Army newspaper, Shinshunpao, which demanded that the Japanese deliver the United States a smashing blow. "We hate the United States, which forgets humane justice," the paper wrote. "The time will come when either we will swallow up the United States, or the United States will swallow us." "Awaken, Asiatic people," it continued. "We must speed up military and diplomatic measures by which we can crush Anglo-American efforts to obstruct the New Order." The New Order the piece referred to was also known as the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, which wasn't all that different from the concept of the Third Reich in Europe. It was a military exploitation of a non-military idea. Original theorists coined the term to suggest Asia should be free from colonial powers through peaceful means. But nationalists had other ideas, as did the military, which hijacked the slogan and used its propaganda machine to bend the term to mean an Asia free from colonial powers, peace be damned. The push was on to fight and reclaim Anglo-occupied territories for Asian people. On July 26, 1941, Roosevelt pushed back with an order that froze Japan's assets, clamping a sweeping control over all economic intercourse between the countries, including ships and silk and cash. He merged American and Filipino troops into one army, and MacArthur was the man who would lead them. "By God, it was destiny that brought me here," the general said of his return to active duty. In August, the United States stopped selling oil to Japan. In September, after the American warship Greer was fired upon by a German submarine, FDR, his wife by his side on the first floor of the White House, gave the Navy orders to shoot on sight any suspected Axis raiders in open water that America deemed vital to its defense. "We have sought no shooting war with Hitler, and don't seek it now," he told the American public. "But neither do we want peace so much that we are willing to pay for it by permitting him to attack our naval and merchant ships while they are on legitimate business." Some in Congress shot back, calling the order an unofficial declaration of war. An investigation into the USS Greer incident was launched by an isolationist U.S. senator, but by then the footfalls toward a fight seemed imminent. In October, as Russia pounded back against Germany in the West, surging and retreating, Japan began claiming that the U.S. and British forces were trying to encircle the country, and the newspapers were filled with stories that war was likely at any time. American intelligence reports suggested the military group in Japan was on the ascendancy. Texas Senator Tom Connally, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was worried that Japan was poised to strike the United States. He read the tea leaves. "It is within the bounds of possibility that we will have trouble with Japan," he told reporters. "In the present situation, anything could happen. If Japan decides that Germany is on top of Russia, she might try to interfere with our shipments of equipment to Russia. Her policy toward us certainly will be hooked up with the German military effort in Russia. Japan," he said, "would like to get something out of this war." Just days later, the Nazis took Bryansk in their advance on Moscow, despite heavy losses in the snowy fields of Russia. The Reds advanced fresh troops constantly in order to stop the surge. A week after the fall of Bryansk, on October 17th, a strongly pro-Axis and heavily militarized faction took over in Japan, unseating moderate premier Prince Fumimaro Konoya, primarily because he hadn't reached an agreement during peace talks with the United States. The takeover came as such a shock that FDR canceled a cabinet meeting and called together his top military advisers, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of the Navy, the Army Chief of Staff, and the Chief of Naval Operations. Their meeting was so private that none of them spoke a word to reporters afterward. 2 days later, FDR announced that he had adopted a wait-and-see policy to give the United States time to determine what the newly empowered Japanese military leaders were going to do. Meanwhile, Japanese leaders were making belligerent statements in the foreign press. The spokesman for the Japanese Navy said they were itching for action. George Norris, a progressive Republican turned independent from Nebraska, didn't like the way things were shaping up. "Like Hitler," he said, "the Japs believe that they are a superior race, destined to rule the world. They have no friendship for the United States and will turn on us when they think it is to their interest." In Manila, MacArthur was trying to make the best of what he had. He didn't expect an attack until April 1942, at the earliest, so he began ramping up defense installations. An $8 million airfield construction project gave the islands about 40 finished airfields and an impressive concentration of war planes. When a shipment of American B-17s flew over Manila on the way to Clark Field, the city cheered. The residents of working-class Tondo packed the streets to watch a parade of M3A1 tanks roll through, bound for Fort Stotzenberg. By the end of October 1941, the rhetoric was fevered. The new Japanese premier, General Hideki Tojo, said that Japan must go on and develop an ever-expanding progress. There is no retreat. "If Japan's 100 millions merge and go forward, nothing can stop us," he said. "Wars can be fought with ease." On October 31st, Halloween, a German U-boat torpedoed the USS Reuben James, which was on neutrality patrol near Iceland, the first sinking of an American destroyer by the Nazis. The ambush killed more than 100 men. German Chancellor Adolf Hitler's spin the following day that the United States had attacked the submarine was viewed as an attempt to pull Japan into the war, and it was followed by increasingly hostile rhetoric in the Japanese press. On December 5th, just as a group of educated Japanese civilians began an effort to convince the government to appoint a commission to try to solve the Pacific deadlock, President Roosevelt learned of the massing of Japanese troops in French Indochina. He called for an explanation. Two of Tokyo's envoys, ambassadors Kichisaburo Nomura and Saburo Kurusu, showed up at the diplomatic entrance to the Department of State. News cameras flashed as the two walked in, smiling blandly. They were ushered into the office of Cordell Hull, the Tennessean who had been Secretary of State since 1933. The two met with Hull for 25 minutes. The United States was demanding that Japan sign a non-aggression pact and evacuate China and Indochina, or its assets would remain frozen. Japan wanted America to halt its naval expansion in the Western Pacific. Talks quickly broke down, and the envoys left Hull with a terse 150-word response from Tokyo, saying Japan was only reacting to aggressive Chinese troop movement. As a natural sequence of this step, certain movements have been made among the troops stationed in the southern part of the said territory. It seems that an exaggerated report has been made of these movements. It should be added that no measure has been taken on the part of the Japanese government that may transgress the stipulations of the Protocol of Joint Defense between Japan and France. The War Department cabled MacArthur saying, "Hostile action possible at any moment," and that "the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act." "Everything is in readiness," MacArthur replied. It was not. Lookouts sighted aircraft north of Manila, near Clark Field. The next day, a Japanese reconnaissance plane was spotted in the sky. The next day, at dawn, planes appeared once again, dark spots in the clouds above a peaceful island. Later, MacArthur would write, "I prepared my meager forces to counter as best I might the attack that I knew would come from the north swiftly, fiercely, and without warning." On the night of December 7th, all of Manila seemed to be partying. The Feast of the Immaculate Conception, the most important event on the calendar, the celebration of the Blessed Virgin Mary receiving the Messiah, was the next day. So the boys and girls danced the night away at the University of the Philippines. There were cocktail parties in Malate and jam sessions in Tondo. The 1,200 men of the 27th Bombardment Group crammed into the Manila Hotel to celebrate their Brigadier General's birthday. As they poured drinks and lit cigarettes, the Empire of the Sun was preparing for war. 2. Fools. The cadets stood in rigid formation on the reviewing grounds, their spines unbowed, rifles at their sides. Father John Fidelis Hurley was shown to his seat, a few feet from the podium erected for his friend the president. He recognized familiar faces in the crowd, practically all the ranking officials of the Commonwealth of the Philippines, Supreme Court justices, congressmen, senators, cabinet members. Beyond them sat thousands, here to watch the formal military review of the young men in the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC, at the University of the Philippines. Hurley, the powerfully built superior of the Jesuit mission since 1936, was friendly with most of the politicians, even if he sparred with them occasionally. Some even attended Sunday Mass at the college he ran, the Ateneo de Manila. In a country where 90% of citizens were Catholic, the line between church and state, if such a line even existed, was blurry. Hurley had come on the advice of a friend, a priest who organized the chaplain corps for the Philippine Army. He told Hurley the day would be unusual, that President Manuel Quezon seemed heavily burdened lately and had spent the week nervously preparing his address. As the cadets finished their drills without incident, Hurley noticed the air was cool and the sky cloudy. It smelled like rain. When Quezon approached the podium to give his speech, the sky opened and a hard, drenching downpour fell. The cadets broke ranks without orders and sprinted for cover. Quezon was angry and bellowed at them, and the boys sheepishly returned. The president clearly had a prepared speech, but he shoved the papers aside and leaned on the podium, his expression stern. "I am here to make a public confession of my first failure in public life," he said. A suppressed laugh rose from the crowd. Quezon was not joking. "If bombs start falling in Manila next week..." Hurley couldn't hear what the president said next because laughter thundered from the crowd. Hurley saw fury in Quezon's eyes. "You fools!" he shouted. The crowd fell silent. "If bombs start falling in Manila next week, then take the traitors and hang them to the nearest lamppost," Quezon continued, trying to warn them that war was coming at any moment and nobody was ready. Hurley had never seen a man so sincerely honest, but the crowd reacted with incredulity, even the cadets. They didn't know that Quezon had spent weeks complaining to U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt about the weak defenses in the islands, or that Quezon had felt the need to tell his countrymen that war was coming when Roosevelt had begged him not to for fear it would upset the delicate international situation. He had defied Roosevelt out of a sense of duty to his people, and they had laughed. 3. Family. Maybe war was coming, but there was always one last dance to be shared at the Silver Slipper, one last holiday.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?